All right, so I actually don't have any slides for this presentation. In this talk, what I'm going to talk about is navigation, the navigation APIs that were released in Prism version 4. Drop 10 is on CodePlex. It's code complete. I think we may have one or two bugs that'll be corrected. I think so. I've been trying to keep up with the traffic. And so I think we have one or two bugs that'll be corrected for the RTM, but I'm using it. I'm using it here. It's fantastic. Okay. So let's crank up our application and let's get going here. So we got this. Should be able to click and start. All right. So what I'm showing you now is on my blog. By the way, my blog, I have several blogs and they'll be in the links are provided. So I have one blog called Developer Guidance, and it has this two recent applications. I just started this blog. I've only been with PMP 7 weeks now, 8 weeks now. Ask Bob, you probably think it's a lifetime. But anyways, so there's a couple of nice applications here. One of them is the one I'm showing you right now is this one right here. Okay, so what this is, what? Oh, you weren't here in the last presentation then, huh? Well, thanks for saying something, Dad. I know they were. Okay, so what this application is an implementation of using Prism region navigation with the Silverlight frame navigation framework. Now, we don't ship with Prism out of the box, we don't ship the necessary code to enable this. That's why we wrote the code, and we've posted it on my blog, and all the code's available here. I'm going to show you the app, and then I'm going to show you the APIs that are in the box. So you get to see both, because a lot of people ask about this. This is why we're showing it. So this app is a really simple app. It allows you, anybody who's done Silverlight frame navigation, you're like, yeah, okay, he took the defaults. Yeah, I did. All right, so now what I want you to notice here, this is a Silverlight app. Notice down here I got a little timer going. See that little timer? It's a little 5 going on. Actually, what I'll do is I'll crank this up so Michael won't be getting on me. All the senior citizens are, coming at me, man, with like little pitchforks. So right here, this is 19 seconds. Now, if I come over here to home, so now in the Silverlight frame navigation, that object is destroyed, right? Everyone knows that. So we come back over here, it's still living and functioning and breathing. We didn't destroy it. Now, we have options to destroy things, which I'll show you. But this is some of the stuff. Now, some of you probably saw my Channel 9 that John, Papa, and I did. I did a Silverlight nonlinear navigation because I wrote my own navigation content loader. But now I'm on the Prism team because I believe in their product. I transferred to them after working a couple years on CIDR, and this is much better. Well, not much better, but it is better because it's fully supported and Prism supported, and we got a good team behind it, and it's a good implementation, and it's actually very simple to program. All right, so anyways, you can see that this is running. Now, if I come over here to my inventory form, and I'll have to make this a little bit smaller. That doesn't matter. So over here, we've got our items. And we can see we have some items here. And if I click here to edit, a couple of things happened. Well, one, we went to the form successfully. That's good. It didn't blow up. But we got a little one here, right? Now, if I re-click this, we can see here that I've got a one here and also got one of these. Now, if I click another one and I go back, maybe I'll just even add one. Now, okay, Carl, yeah, that's great, but what's the application? Well, the application is the end user is sitting at their desk, Susie. So Susie is adding a new record, and her boss comes up to her in the middle of adding a record. She's got 50 fields in her form and blah, blah, blah. She's typing, and she doesn't want to have to retype everything. She doesn't want to have to save or cancel. So what we're going to allow Susie to do is to navigate over to another form, could be another module. By the way, that inventory is in a separate module. We're going to allow that work to stay exactly the way it was, down to focus on the field, what field has focus. And what we're going to do is we're going to allow her to go execute another task. And when that task is over, we're going to allow her to come back. Oh, that's pretty cool. Now, here's what's really cool. You see this data that's being surfaced here where I got item 3 and inventory 3? All this is a little collection. I'm just putting a count up there. So what you could do, and what I've done in the barbecue shack, which is on my blog, is you can actually have like little, they can right click and see a context menu, or you can have a little glyph where they hover over it and it pops down and then, you know, it allows them to select a record right up there. You could picture a Zune style menu that had each of the modules going across, and then when you click the module, showed all the available selections for that user, and if they had any active element or active forms, that would show the below. It could be endless, right? All right. So I can come over here to category. I can edit my category. All right, so now we got all this stuff you can see here that makes it very easy for the user to see what she's, he or she's doing. And if I want to close one of these, see, I can just pull it out. See how easy that works? This is great. So this allows us to write a really cool Silverlight app and utilize the region navigation, the Prism region navigation system. By the way, of all the links you saw me click, only one of them has any code. Huh. No converters. It's all XAML. So let's just take a quick peek at this so we can understand what in the world Carl's talking about. So over here, I think what I'll do is I'm going to go hide my toolbox. We're not going to need that anymore. And we'll bring this up here. And Michael was complaining about the font size, which is already 16. Just to know that I actually went and changed it before I started. He's never going to let me live this down. See, keyboard, the fonts, shiftlet. See, I told you I was responsible. I even slowed my mouse down, and, you know, I pre-did everything, thought everybody would be happy. Well, it didn't happen. All right. So let's take a look over here. Here's my application. So let's crack open the shell, and this... this particular code, anybody who's written Silverlight region navigation, by the way, it's nice that the designer works too, right? Everything that we ship on the Prism library works in the designer. We don't ship anything. We test every form to make sure they're fully designable, fully blendable, right? Can't talk about blendability if we're not blendable, right? So we practice what we preach. This is the standard style code you get for the buttons, you know, that they give you. Right here is where we begin to sniff and smell some Prism. So for those of you that have done Prism, and I'll unhighlight this. I actually don't like when people highlight things because then you can't see them and they don't realize that. Anyways, when you look at this, Prism has this notion of regions. So a region is it's actually implemented as an attached property. That's what that is. And it attaches itself to some kind of control, and through adapters that we provide, or you can implement yourself, and also behaviors, not blend behaviors, but Prism behaviors, we're able to actually allow the region to work with any kind of control, like a tab control, items control, list box. And in my next demo, you're going to actually see that in action, where parts of the UI are list boxes, other parts our content controls. So in this case, we don't have a content control, we have a frame. So the Prism team wrote the software that's required for that region to play nice with the Silverlight frame control. Now, the only other piece of code you're going to have to write, it's going to take you forever, is this line right here. You're going to put in a custom content loader, the one we give you. And now, what you can do now is you can utilize frame navigation, utilizing our entire navigation stack that's built in that we give you from XAML, or, at your option, you can initiate a navigation in code. No problem. One little simple line of code, and you can now navigate. You have full control over the lifetime of your object. So if you want, when a particular object comes in or out, when it goes moved in or moved out, you can bring them. When you navigate away, you can destroy the object. You can keep it. You can prevent navigation from ever happening because we actually ask you. We have all different kind of, our pipeline is very detailed, and you can implement it as little or as much as you want. So it's up to you how you want to do things. All right. So how did I do that URI? Oh, by the way, I should have showed you this. What's this? You're going to love this. So I come over here. Yeah, this is IE. Yeah, this new version is just, at times, could be very temperamental, like testing my patience, you know. Anyways, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to come up here and I'm going to copy that URL. I'm going to go over to a new instance of my new tab. In fact, you know what, because I know there's some Missouri folks here, they want to see it. We'll just do a new whole browser. So shift insert. What is it doing? There's a communist who's planted some kryptonite under my table here. I know what's going on. I bet it was Bob. He wants to get into my mojo. No, I recognize that. Yeah, it's because I went and did this so that I could make it easier, and as it turned out, it wasn't easier for anybody. Sorry about that, guys. I'm boring you with my inability to copy, cut, and paste after all these years. So we come over here. Let's make this bigger so we're going to look okay. And we do shift insert and presto. By the way, I haven't tested this in about a couple weeks. So I hope it works. Oh, hello, hamsters. You have to press enter. Well, yeah, it's the hamsters inside that are causing the problem. You guys, you didn't know that? There's like this conspiracy with hamsters. So let's see what's going on here. So what's happening is my Silverlight control isn't loading. It has nothing to do with, so you can see my Silverlight control didn't even load. And we can thank IE for this. We've had a number of problems with IE9. So if you're a developer, see, now it's working. So if you, I'm not slanting on IE. I work for Microsoft. We tell the truth. So it's a beta. No, we tell the truth. You want to know the truth? You can ask anybody on the PMP team. We're going to tell you the truth. We don't hide anything. So IE's got a number. It's brand new. Does a lot of things really well. On a few things, they probably didn't test very well or didn't get to yet. And one of them is initiating Silverlight apps like this. Sometimes they don't light up right away. Or you get the error. It happens. So it's not your code. So you can see here, what did I just do? Well, that's a deep link. Well, yeah, that's kind of cool. So that means a user of your application that was implemented using frame navigation could actually set a favorite if they wanted to for a certain page or a record, and then they could go back to it. What's another use of this kind of deep linking, Carl? Well, it's kind of cool that, so let's say that you had an application you wanted to have the reminders, right? So a user is on a record, and they say, I want to set a reminder. Well, what you can do is you can just copy that URL in your code, save it in your database, whatever, and then when that reminder comes up, you've already got the URL. You just click on it, presto, you go right there. Oh, that's pretty cool. So there's all kind of dashboardy things you could do. You could email somebody a link, and they could go right there, blah, 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 right? That kind of stuff. So deep linking's got some cool, it's got some goodness. It's kind of cool. All right, so I showed you deep linking. Sorry that we got randomized by the browser again. Oh, man. Okay. So what I want to do is I'll show you this. Very, very simple. Now, the way that I did it, in Prism, in addition to regions, we have this concept of modules. And, okay, Carl, what's a module? It's an assembly. Obviously, it could be, you could have lots of modules in the same assembly, but typically, Prism, people who are going to use Prism, they want to decompose their applications into modules. So this way you could load a module on demand, or you could load a module for some security, or it makes it easier for people in India to write this module. Russia's over here. United States is trying to do theirs here, and South America's over here. By the way, in Prism team, we're worldwide, our members of our team, and so we have to function this way all the time. So when you break down applications like this, it makes it easy for people to work on different segments of the code. So we come over here, we take a look at this URI mapper, and this is where all the mojo happens. So you can see here, this URI mapper is really cool. What it does is it breaks it down, and depending on the shape of the URI mapper takes it and it tries to parse and figure out what kind of URI it's got. And then what it does, it converts it to a mapped URI. And in this case, you could see I'm using full type names, right? Everybody figured that out pretty quick. So I'm just using full type names. And at the end, we got this little key, and key for zero, that's add. And then if you have a real key, this means go get the page. And this is one where it doesn't have a record that you're looking up. So you can easily see here, this is very, very simple to set up. You only have to do this once and you're done. So very, very cool the way to set this up if you want to use Silverlight frame navigation. Now, Carl, you said something about modules. Well, down here we got this inventory module, right? And so it's got some views here. So why don't we go over and take a peek at the category view? So in my category view, well, actually, sorry, we don't want to look at that. We actually want to look at this other one because this is the inventory view is the one that has the magic. This is that view where you saw here that allows you to, you know, had some functions, and it's got these two list box here. So let's go take a look at this list box, and I'm going to show you the data template because this is where all the fun is. You see that hyperlink button right here? Everybody see that hyperlink button? Let's go over and take a look at how we navigate. So the navigation URI, that's when if you click on the hyperlink, it'll navigate the frame that it's in to that URI. And you can see here, I'm taking the item ID. That's my property inside my data context. See how cool data binding is if you've never seen it before? And now look what I'm doing. I'm using a string format function. So what am I doing? I'm just taking that key, which is an integer in my case, and I'm just going here and say inventory item view looks just like the URI that I typed, the URL that I typed up in my browser. It looks just like that. I don't need any code. So I don't have to go and execute code and go figure out stuff. Well, you say, well, Carl, what happens if there's an exception? Oh, well, we get that covered because we have the ability to, we have an event on our region navigation service that raises if there's a problem. You could capture that in a centralized location. Also, frame navigation has a frame navigation error event. You could capture that also, too. So you're able to safely navigate from XAML without, you know, with peace of mind. Because to be honest, if you navigate and the record's not there, you don't want to go to that screen anyway. You want to go back to where you came from, right? Because if the record's not there because somebody deleted it or you made a boo-boo, then yeah, it's usually the programmer, right? Or the data. So you can see how simple that was, right? So writing these Silverlight applications, you shouldn't have to write a lot of code to navigate around. You really shouldn't. So if we take a peek in our view model, and then we're going to go look at our other app. If we take a look at this view model, so we got a few. This iNavigationAware, this is our big interface. We have another one you can use. And so these are the buttons. These are the strings for the buttons. Here's my data items. Those are the two collections that you saw listed in the list boxes. See how I surface my data to my UI? I just have a property. The UI binds to it. The UI shows it. All right? Very, very simple stuff. Here's my properties for my buttons. When I clicked on inventory or I clicked on category, these properties were altered. This is where the button text comes from. See, I even had a property there. So you saw that when I had item and category, when there was a record being edited in those particular modules for those tables, then you saw there was a 2 or 3 or 1. Well, the way that happened was, see, in the old days, you'd have to write code that would address a name control. But now we got XAML and data binding, right? Now all we have to do is expose a public property. And so whenever that view loads up, it goes in and it grabs this property. So I don't need change notification on here because this isn't dynamically changing. That's why you don't see it. Only the properties that are dynamically changing, those are the ones that you need it. But in this case, it just loads up. It reads the property through a one-time data binding. And I go and I make the little label for it, give it back to it. Oh, that's easy. So now I don't have tight coupling. So if my designer says, Carl, you know, that lame, you know, text that you had is not going to work here. Well, I need to have another control that does different, it's better, and looks fancy, and it has a hover over. He doesn't need to talk to me about it because he's going to data bind the information and show it up on his screen. We're using MEF, so we're injecting this region manager. Pretty simple here. And this case, in this particular app, I'm just calling this business logic layer, and it's just dynamically generated data. It's not going into a database on this one. The next one does. So you can see here, here's our navigation stuff. So we've got a couple of methods that you override, and that's it. And that's all you have to do. In the next app I'm going to show you, I've actually written a detailed complex base class that actually handles all this for you. So you can opt into the things you want, right? Does anybody got a question about, in the next talk, and when I go to the next program, I'll take you into a little bit more detail. I just wanted to show you this as a high up overview. Anybody got a question about Silverlight, frame navigation? So the part that we, the part that we provide, or you can get off my blog, is right here, which is this library, Prism Frame Region Navigation. That's the only piece you need. It has all the classes right here you need, and the frame, we have this little wrapper and a bunch of other stuff, and I've got documentation out on my on the blog that explains how this works. Any question about that part? Yes, sir. Oh, it's completely supported. Sorry, excuse me. The question was, does the back button work? Absolutely. So that was a P0 for us. And so as you implement the back button, it'll just navigate back to where it was. We maintain a back stack. Now, in the case of the frame navigation, we actually tie into the back stack that's provided by the browser. So we don't go and it just works the way you would think it would work. Does that answer your question? Yeah, it goes to the previous, not website, but it'll go to the previous URL. Well, I guess, yeah, if you backed away from it, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So the back button works the way you would expect. All right. So now this application, and this one I haven't put up on my blog. It'll be up there next week, along with the feature builder, the feature extension. So let me spin this up. This is WPF, and now the first time, oh, they're good. My data service lit up. Sometimes my data service wasn't lighting up. All right, it's going to look very familiar. WPF, it's got an about screen. It's got the same little thing down here, and you can adjust it and make the font big for Michael. So you can see it now. It's got a few little words. And then I come over to my inventory, and now what it's doing, it goes out and see my service died because it didn't load the data. So this is why I tested it like 100 times. So I'll come back over here, and this time it'll start, and it'll load the data properly, something with the service that goes on. All right, so what I just did, I loaded 1,000 records into this box. That's a lot of records. That went over OData. You can see there's 1,000 of them here. This particular application works the same way as the other one. You can click. You get the same thing. You know, you can click. I mean, and you can turn one off. You can go back over here. It's the same. It's just exactly the same as the other one, okay? As far as how it works, how it's implemented, completely different. But it uses the region navigation APIs that you can use and consume in your WPF and Silverlight applications. Let me be really clear. Silverlight frame navigation is an add-on to Silverlight. So if you want to write a Silverlight application and not use frame navigation, then your application itself is responsible for moving things in and out of the UI. Everybody knows that. If you use frame navigation, now you're going to allow sort of a web experience for your individual pages that are navigated in a frame inside your application. So erase Silverlight frame navigation from your local RAM, from your L2 cache, get rid of that. And now we're just going to talk about Prism region navigation. And everything I tell you works for both WPF and Silverlight. So this navigation framework, like just about everything we do on the Prism team, works for both WPF and Silverlight. Some details, implementation details may be a little bit different, but the end result is, and the APIs work exactly the same, okay? So let's talk about what's going on here, how this was built. So down here at the bottom is a web service that I exposed over OData. Remember Donbox? He talked about OData. So I have a database here that's got two tables. One's got 1,000 rows. The other one's got like 100 in it. And I have this little service. And with four line, or I don't know, what is it? I got rid of my line numbers because you can't see them. Or it takes up too much space. So into this little bit of code, I was actually able to expose all the data right here on a single endpoint. This is how you expose OData's endpoints. Now, you could do other stuff, but basically owe data, like these other REST services, all come out of one endpoint, and then you just navigate from there. This is all the code you need to expose data as an owe data source. Right here is where you can set your rules. So I just got them set to all because I don't want to fool with it for a demo, right? But you can actually have nice rules here to protect your data, to make it read-only, I mean, only let certain people, whatever, right? Okay. So this is how I expose the data for this application. This is the simplest way I've ever seen to implement data for a demo. It's just so easy. And then to consume this, you just do like you've always done in every application. You create a service reference right here, and you get this nice little proxy that lets you communicate using link. Oh, that's cool. I don't have to write SQL. I can write link statements, and Microsoft provided the classes necessary to translate your link into an OData URL. Because remember, OData only works with URLs. It can take that, translates your request into an OData URL, and brings you back the data. That's pretty neat. All right. So that's how we get our data. Then I have this little, modules like I always have. I have two modules, and I have a little library that's got some common functions, and I have my main app. Let's take a look at our main app real quick. Now, we talk about separation of concerns. This is all my main app has. I have this shell here, and it has hardly any XAML. So if we take a look at this XAML here, what you're going to find is I got a little doc panel, and here it has an items control right here. See that items control? So this dock panel, the reason it's a dock panel is so that I can put my phone, my title, and my little image over here. That's this business of a stack panel down here. But right here, this is an items control. Remember I told you that you could use regions, and regions can attach themselves onto WPF and Silverlight controls. And right here, I've attached the region manager, region name attached property, which brings in all the goo when you do this, into a region called navigation region. And so what this is, when you saw those buttons at the top, right? So when I spun this application up, notice you got home, about, and inventory. These were loaded automatically by a process that when you read our documentation, called view discovery. And view discovery is kind of simple. It's where you could take during a registration process, or what we call module initialization, you can actually tell the region manager, hey, here's a type, and when you get time, I want you to take this type, utilize whatever kind of container I've got registered, build that type, and automatically put that type in this container. And that's all you have to do. That's called view discovery. It's very, very simple. It's extremely powerful. And you say, well, Carl, I don't get the power. Yeah, I know. But you will in a second. Spin this back up for a second. So we got home, about, inventory. Okay? Come back down here, because a lot of people have asked these kind of questions during this time. Notice I have something called information, and I got one called inventory. Well, information, what it has here, it's got this thing called an about navigation view item, and this one is called a home navigation view item. Now, if I come into my initialization code, look what I'm doing here. Right here, I'm in my initialization code. I'm calling my region manager, so I'm registering with the navigation region. I'm just saying, hey, when you load yourself, I also want you to go and load these guys. And this is all accomplished by the behaviors. Remember, I talked about behaviors. When a region is attached to a control, it has behaviors. And one of those behaviors is an autoloader. And so it says, oh, you've registered some types. I'm going to suck them in for you and display them. Oh, well, that's pretty cool. That means I don't have to do that. Yeah. Now, what's really neat is we also added the ability right here. See this second guy here called a view sort hint? So let's say that you had 10 modules and you wanted these to automatically show up across the bar at the top, or maybe sort of an Outlook paradigm, but you wanted them in a certain order, but those aren't really alphabetically ordered. So what we did, recognizing this, and Prism 4, the Prism team, wrote and implemented this view sort hint, which allows you to, on any type that's going to be view discovered, you can provide a hint to us, and we will, if it's there, we will sort by that hint. So you can deterministically ensure that things are placed in a certain order. So in my case, home, about, inventory. That's the way I want them done. So it's pretty simple. I did it the way I want it. And that's how, so all this is a string. Carl is allergic to strings in his code, so you won't see any. Except sometimes with property change notification, because I use a code snippet to write it anyway. I never have to type those. I just do it with a code snippet, and I don't worry, or I code-gen my stuff. But I also, you can also use that lambda expression thing. But we fully support both of that in our base classes. So if you think about this, now I've explained how about got there, but let me come over here. Let me close these down. So that there's your about button. There's your home button. Oh, that's cool. And those are the associated views. Now, notice something here. So this about button, let's actually go back to that for a second. I probably glanced over something too quick. Notice here, when that button got clicked, it called the region manager, main region, and it said, hey, request navigate about. And in this case, it's full name, because I do everything by full name. That way, because, you know, in .NET, we have this really cool feature called namespaces. So you could have 50 50 types named customer, although that'd be pretty dumb. But you could have 50 individual customer classes in different namespaces, and you could actually instantiate each of those differently. So if you use full name versus short name, because we support both. We support both full type name. We also support a custom way of doing this. It's very easy to implement if you wanted to. But I like to use full type name, because then it guarantees I'm not going to have a little collision problem in case somebody was having a bad day, right? Because that happens. Anyways, so if you look at this, look how simple that was to implement this. One line of code. Now, that's cool for an about box and a home screen. Yeah, okay, great. But how does that really work for my applications that I'm going to write? Because, you know, my users need a lot more than just a screen. Well, what I did was here in my inventory, I have this module, same song and dance. Prism is all about repeating patterns. Patterns of practices is all about repeating the same pattern to end up with a predictable result. This is what we're about, right? We spend a lot of time and money thinking about things before we publish them, and they have to be vetted through a lot of people and our high-level architects like David Hill, and Bob, and our Michael, who presented yesterday, right? And then we have community advisors. So there's a lot of thought that goes into what patterns and practices delivers, right? We it's just our way of doing things. It costs more. Our cadence, we do a good cadence, but we really invest a lot of time in thinking stuff out. We're just not out there on the next bandwagon. That's not us, right? That's one of the reasons I joined the team. Because they listen to feedback. Isn't that nice? When you can send in a request and you'll be heard, it's awesome. All right, so here's my inventory module. Now notice in my initialize, what am I doing? I'm telling View Discovery System, hey, I want you to load up this. Okay, cool. I can do that, Carl. So now, let's get out of full screen. So now, what is that? Well, here's that little button. All it is a button. Here he is right here. So it's a button, and in this case, he's got a view model, right? And he's got it right over here. Here's his view model. And I did it with a view model for a couple reasons, because it got more than just a click. As soon as I got more than one click handler, forget about it. So what I've got here is I've got a way to have a menu item automatically discovered based on registration. So that means if I had an application that I was responsible for that had 10 full-blown modules, HR, sales, customers, healthcare, payroll, whatever, right? I mean, whatever vertical you happen to be in, and user A was only allowed to see 4 of those modules, then I could dynamically load those modules, and that module's entry point, which is what that button is, right? It's kind of an entry point in a menu to get to the whole thing, is automatically dynamically loaded, and they can't see the other stuff. In fact, they don't even have the other assemblies on their box. So that's kind of cool. So what's really going on here? So here's my navigate command. That's simple. We're just navigating request. It knows where to go. But I also got this thing called the event aggregator. See this thing down here? In my importing constructor, I'm bringing in an event aggregator so that I can go ahead and listen for an event. When that event gets raised, I can set my text on my button right here. That's what this guy does. And that's how I get the 1, 2, 3, and all that stuff. All right, Carl, what's an event aggregator? In a composite application, or in an application where you've got, I mean, if you think about it, those buttons are up here. They don't know anything about what's going on in the other region, do they? And it would be poor design to tightly couple them in any way, because now your code's brittle, hard to test, can't change it. So what we have, and there's other implementations, we're not the only one. If you go to Laurent's blog, he's got this MVVM framework called MVVM Lite, super respected. Rocky has a framework, super respected. Prism has an implementation. It's called Event Aggregator. Theirs are called Messenger. Rocky, are you in the room? Oh, he's gone. Okay, so he's got another implementation. And so if you hear Messenger and Event Aggregator, they're pretty much the same thing. Inside, they're different. I happen to like the Prism. In fact, I was using Prism Event Aggregator before I joined the team because I like the way that they have the ability to marshal events across different threads. There's a way you can set these options so you can subscribe to the events on different threads when you get called back. So over here is my menu, and over here I'm navigating to a new inventory item. So when I navigate that, if it's an inventory item and I'm adding it, what I want to do is raise an event. And I want to say, hey, somebody just navigated to inventory. So the button's over here. It's listening for somebody to say, hey, inventory got navigated. And when inventory gets navigated, it comes down here, and it runs this code. So you can see here that it's subscribing, and the delegate is here. And when it happens, I'm going to post back to the dispatcher. I'll explain that in a second. And it does that same thing we did before. It just loops through. Here's the regions collection here. And it says, hey, how many of you guys are inventory people? Oh, fine, I got 6. Good, I'll put my little number up there. That's it. So that's one way to have decoupled communications between loosely coupled components. That's what Event Aggregator is about. Carl, why did you post this update to the UI on the dispatcher? In WPF, a lot of stuff goes on. I mean, a lot of stuff. Like, what you saw here was just changing a screen. But a designer may decide that he wants to spin this thing in 360s and move it over and change the colors and bring in, you know, Flipper to, you know, announce the new form. And this all kind of crazy stuff. So by posting this to the dispatcher, it allows it to add it to the list of the things the dispatcher has to do. It typically ends up at the end, so when all that other stuff is done, it'll update this and it won't get lost in the shuffle. And there's a number of cases where, and even in our Prism team, we've had things where people have said, you know, this isn't updating. I'm running the code, but it doesn't change the screen. And you know, I'm just like, oh, post to the dispatcher, it works. But, oh, really? Yeah, and to be honest, I don't fully understand exactly why. I'm like, well, why do I have to resend, why do I have to put the message on another queue or put it at the end of the queue just to get it to work? But you do sometimes. So both Silverlight and WPF, I'm finding that sometimes when I write to the UI, I want to post it to the dispatcher. And this is how you do it. It's very easy, and it guarantees the UI is going to be updated properly. Okay. So here, what we've discovered here, we've walked through some view discovery. We understand that if we implement in our module initializer, we're allowed to tell the Prism region manager, hey, go get these types and put them in there for us. That's pretty cool. And now, what's really nice is I've actually injected the entire inventory module into the shell, which doesn't have any knowledge of me whatsoever. And so from this point here, when they click that button, now the UI can now display inventory kind of functions. And if I had a button for sales, sales could do the same thing. I think you get what I'm talking about. All right. So let's talk about more navigation items. So how do we navigate in WPF? All right, good question. So over here, this is my inventory. This is that big screen. Oops, that's my button. Wrong one. Here's my inventory one. And I'll get to this sample data in a minute. By the way, that's sample data. That's pretty cool, huh? It shows you all the data from the same form. So I'll show you how I did that. It's actually a couple lines of code. What I want to show you is how we navigate. So we're in WPF, and we have to find our data template. So here's my data. Where's my data template at? My data template's up here. So here's my data template. Here's my button. And what I'm doing here is I'm using a command here. So inside my data template for all of the items. Now, if you got to think about something, this form is reuse, isn't it? Because if I click on custom, or if I click on category, category show, and then they also show on the other side. If I click on an item, so this form's written a little bit so it can be reused, and you could picture a search bar at the top, right? That's what I did in Barbecue Shack. So you could see that when somebody comes into inventory, it has all your functions listed, and then as you click on them, you can present a search screen. They can go find the records they want to work with. And then they could see all the ones that they have active. So that's how I did it, this thing in Barbecue Shack. And it's also the way Billy Hollis did his presentation. If you go to my blog, I actually have a link to his talk. If you haven't seen it and you do UI development, I strongly recommend you watch it. So in this case, we're using a command. Now, I didn't have time to write a behavior, which I'll do it maybe this weekend or early next week. So a behavior is nothing more than a class that gets instantiated in XAML. And what it allows you to do, instead of having to call code, you can just use a behavior, and it'll just execute the navigation from right here. But I just didn't have time to write the behavior and to do it correctly. So I don't believe in doing things not 100%, because then I always end up having to go back and do them over again. But anyway, so you can see here, I'm also passing a parameter. Notice in my data a command has a command property command parameter property. So here, I can pass in my category ID. So let's go see how that works. By the way, we should sneak in there and take a look at the view model. I'm sorry, the code behind. Oh, wow, Carl, it did all that functionality and you don't have any code? Nope, don't need it. That's code behind, right? So I'm not going to be able to do a lot of testing here. So in here, all I'm doing is I'm importing my view model. So I'll talk about wiring up view models in about 5 minutes. So right here, I'm just importing it and setting it to the data context. This is one way that you can get your view model wired up to your view. It's the way that I like to do it if I'm not doing interception. If I'm doing Unity, then I can inject this automatically. I don't even need this code. Chris was schooling me on that earlier today, telling me how I can do things. And also Daniel back there was talking to me about a better way to do stuff. It's a good reason to come to these conferences. You learn how to do things that you didn't know yesterday. So let's look at our navigation. So if we look at our properties, we can go find that navigate command, right? So over here, we got a command called navigate. How do I get to it? Shiftlet? Okay. So I've got a little property here called navigate. Now you're going to see here, this is Dylance for 1 second. If you look right here, I've got two commands implemented a little bit different. See how one of them does lazy installation, the other one just does it once? So the reason that I do the top one in lazy installation is because that one is going to be reused for every single item in the list box. So there's no reason to go and create a new one for every time somebody needs it. We'll just use the same instance, right? Kind of makes sense. But the add command is only ever going to be data bound once. So I can just return it back new. I don't have to have a backing field. That's why we did that. So you do what works for you. I'm just showing you a good pattern here. So when the navigate command gets executed, what we're going to do is we're going to just request navigate to the URI. And that's it. That's all we're going to do. There's my URI string. We're done. So this is all you have to do. Now, I should probably make this clear. Let me take you into this. This is our base class. Now, if I come back over here to my view model, and by the way, you can implement your navigation in either view model or the view. Notice here that I don't have any of the navigation stuff implemented in my interfaces, do I? That's in my view model. And that's because I wrote this navigation aware view model base, which actually handles all of those events. It handles all of the navigation requests. It will do it for you, like is navigation target, just say true, because I don't have records. I don't need to differentiate between, there's only ever one instance of this particular view, so I'll never have more than one instance, but like for an items or category, I could have multiple instances. In that case, I need to defer that to the actual object. But down here, what I did is I created a bunch of overloads to make it easy to create these request navigates. You see how long, how you have this long code? Right, and there's all different kind of forms that can take. So what I did is last night I sat down and I was like, you know what, I got to write something better for these guys because otherwise they're going to be like, Carl, it's too complicated. So what we did instead, we have a great API, and I just tried to make it a little bit simpler for people like me who like things simple. So I just now have a request navigate, and I'm going to pass this region here and my URI string. And what will happen is, this method will take that and convert it and make it into the right format. So the developer never has to concern herself or himself with exactly how to do things. Okay? Like, this code should just be simple, right? Then there's less bugs or no bugs. And easy to write. Very easy to construct this code. All right. So that's how you navigate. This is how you move around inside our Prism stuff. Now, down here, right here we have, remember I told you every time we navigate we want to publish an event. So I'm listening for the navigated event and I'm publishing, letting everybody know. And so this is all pretty much the same stuff until we get to right here. Now, and I'm going to camp here for a minute and then we'll get into sample data. What I decided to do, this right here loads up 1,000 records, this line of code here. See that? All right. Those of you who do AOP, you're going to be really happy right now because I'm in your space a little bit. But right up here, and when I wrote Barbecue Shack and so many of the other apps I wrote, I was always finding myself writing a try-catch block and doing the same repetitive checks for a save operation, a delete operation, whatever kind of operation that you go out and talk to the data, right? On top of that, if you're a conscientious programmer, even if you're in WPF and not just Silverlight, you want to always make your data calls asynchronously, right? So that way the UI stays responsive, the user doesn't have to keep clicking and going cuckoo, and then the screen turns white, thank you, one of those jobbers. So you can't ship that. And so I've been spending the last couple months thinking about this, and then I was reading member A did a presentation for us the other day on parallel programming. And so I read the book, and I didn't quite get everything. And because it takes me time to learn, I'm not as smart as most people. So I have to read the stuff over and over again a few times. Because my learning process is I need to learn what you're saying, but then how do I make it fit into my world? And once I can do that, then I'm home free. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to reduce all of those lines of code, get error handling, and get asynchronous callbacks in one line of code. That's what that does. When that line of code executes, it drops through that line of code right there in less than a millisecond. That's all it takes. And you got to be saying, what are you talking about? Yeah. So let's talk about it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call into this facade, and I'll show you both implementations. I'm going to call the get all. I'm going to go get all 1,000 records to prove that this thing works. And basically, all I'm going to do is the result of that, and there's actually two callbacks here. You see right here, there's a comma there. So this side is the result of, hey, this is the good result. No errors, database was working, didn't have the wrong whatever. And so what happens is the result comes back, exactly what you're expecting, and you can take it and assign it to the data source. If there's a boo-boo, then what can happen is this other callback, which, by the way, is in the base class, so that my code never, because it's always going to do the same thing. You're going to grab the exception, and you need to, you know, pull out the string if you're in real, you know, runtime mode, and somehow put some dialogue up somewhere, right? Or do an overlay, right? of an exception. So what's happened is now I got all my, because the exception at this point's already been logged. All we want to do is tell the user, right? So I got one line of code that handles getting it and returning it. So let's take a look at what we have here, and you'll understand this very easily to grasp. So in this business folder, I've got an item repository. So here it is in its glory. There's get all. So there's my data service being imported by MEF, injected. My data service, so I have a data service facade, and all that is a wrapper around the OData data service, and it wires it up. So here I'm passing in an instantiated data service, and here I'm calling the instantiated data service. I'm saying, give me all my items and do to list. By the way, if you're using link and you didn't do to list here, when does the query actually get executed? Does anybody know off the top of your head? Yeah, when it's used. So if you don't put to list, nothing actually happens. You won't get any parallel programming. You won't get any other processing. In fact, it'll hang up the UI for about 30 seconds and ask me how long it took me to figure this out. I was so mad at myself for being an idiot. So what I did is I just put my to list on there, and that what that does, that actually forces the query to execute. It's all on the task parallel library. It's taken care of. It's running. It's all good. So now, but right now, we don't have any parallel programming, do we? We just have a typical service layer that's going to call some method, right? That's all we got. No exception handling, nothing. So now, what we've got here, our next item is our facade. Oh, that's my interface. Well, we want to see the implementation, Carl. We don't need to see your interface. So it's hard to see. I need like a really big screen like I have at home. All right. So if we look here, so we've got this. So here's what's happening. It's taken an inner repository, and that would be what we just looked at. So I'm passing that in. This facade is acting as a decorator for the concrete implementation of our facade or of our data service that we just looked at. And so here's my getAll method. Now, the getAll method, very simple. It takes an action, right? Here it takes a callback that's going to get an enumerable of item. That's what we want. We want a nice list of items. And if there's a problem, I want a callback that takes an exception. All right. So what we do is we use what they call the futures pattern. All right, so I'm going to start here at the task. So there's two kinds of patterns. You can do parallel task and you can do futures. So in this case, what we have here, a future is something that's going to come back in the future. It's not very difficult to understand. The reason you know it's a future is because it says task of T. So that means it's going to give you something back, right? And it's not going to give it back to you right away. This code will drop through in a millisecond, less than a millisecond, and it'll continue on until you ask for it or until you wait for it. In my case, what I'm doing is I'm starting up my call right here, and this task scheduler is incredibly smart. Microsoft has some super, super, super smart, sharp people write the parallels underneath all the really deep, very difficult, hard code to write. And then on top of that, they put this thing called the TPL, which is a nice developer-friendly wrappers or API that we can use and leverage. Because what I have here is complete asynchronous programming, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to new up this, or I'm going to create a task. Right here, you got this task factory start new. Kind of does everything at once. It news it up, gets all the plumbing started, and actually starts your task. And by the way, all this code could be extracted into a generic do something of T. I just didn't have time to do it. I actually want to sit with Glenn and do this. We'll sit down and pair program and do it. But you say, Carl, well, where's our try catch block? How did you catch your exception? I did it right here. So inside on the other thread, this is the background thread, running on multiple cores, right? Because it's all the TPL thing is designed to take your jobs and run up as much as it can. It knows how to schedule. It knows how to crank up cores. It knows how to interact with the operating system to get you the maximum performance at no cost to you other than writing the little bit of code, which is actually easier than what we wrote before with all that other eventing things and stuff we had to do. And so here, what I'm really doing is I'm taking this, but here I'm just calling inner get all. That's like calling the repository. That's the code we called. But we're doing it inside this other environment on another core, on another thread, on another processor. I mean, just all isolated from my UI. So my UI stays very responsive, and we're using the other cores. Because some machine, I mean, some of us got i7s, right? How many cores you got? What, 8 that run at, you know, 0.01% most of the time? So down here, now if there's, so what happens is, if everything goes good, I'm just going to return right here this. I'm going to return my result. If there's a boo-boo, I'm going to return an exception. But notice I'm wrapping it in this repository result. The reason I do that is because this task, this drops through, and then this task continue with, it sits here and it waits until the other, to this code up here, is done processing. Then what I do is I take that result, that little package I made, and I say, oh, so here's the kind of code you write today. You get back a result from an async result or some kind of callback, and it usually has there's a class there that exposes result and exposes error, right? Everybody's seen that. And then you have to write the same code over and over again. If it's an error, do this. If it's good, do that. Well, I didn't want to write any of that code. I have to write it somewhere, so I decided to write it up in a facade layer that's running in parallel, so I get really good response. And here, I either call the callback or I call the error callback. Notice the one thing to notice at the bottom. See where it says the very last thing, where it says task scheduler from current synchronization context? What that means is I want you to call back on the thread that initiated this whole process. So this way, when my UI calls in, it's guaranteed that my callback will come on the UI thread. So that's why you saw this almost naked code up on my UI, up on my view model layer. I got one line. It's really, really simple. So, and by the way, we'll genericize this. You can also generate this really easy. And so the get method does the same thing. It's really, really simple. In fact, here, let me show you what I did here on the get method. I pass in an ID. Now, if the ID is not 0, then I go and get it. If the ID is 0, well, that means that they want a new record. So what I do is I come down here and I call into the repository and I create it. I'm like Rocky. I strongly believe in the view models never newing up business objects. It's not a good thing. And so I always knew them up in my business layer. Because you never know when there's going to be a requirement, right? Because my business objects, I actually run rules and all kinds of stuff whenever they get created. So when they get marshaled up to the UI, they're all data bound in their state that if they have any errors, that'll show up. Okay. All right, so let's come down here. And I can see the alligators are swarming over here. So that was out the corner of my eye. Okay, so so that's how I send back a new one. All right, now, if we come back to our view model, now my view model code, obviously you have to have code in your view model, but when you come down here, this is all I need to load all that up. That's it. And my dependency injection container takes care of all that for me. I don't have to do anything. It news up all the dependencies and figures out what interface is what and builds up my concrete classes and does this. Now, one of the great benefits is, if you know anything about interception, is that because everything is done here through an interface, this facade layer, I can actually attach, using interception, I can actually attach additional decorators onto this facade that could do things like logging exceptions to a database, security checking, doing what they call cross-cutting concerns. So when you follow a simple pattern like this, it enables you over time to grow your application, to do things, to implement your cross-cutting concerns using interception in a very object-oriented way, and it keeps each object very solid, which means it has a very a single responsibility. It doesn't do 10 things. See, if you look at my objects, it doesn't do one thing. It only does one thing. It goes and gets data and sends it back. That's it. It doesn't have to do anything else. And obviously you have to catch exceptions, but it didn't log an exception here, did it? That should be done by somebody else. This class should know how to log exceptions. All right. So there's one thing I want to cover, and then we're going to take our break. So what I want to show you right here is about sample data. So over here in my item view, now notice my item view has some controls. I'm going to click on this text box, and notice here that the data binding builder is lit up. A gentleman had come up to me and asked me, Carl, how do I get the data binding builder lit up if my view model is instantiated in code behind like this, or it's injected? Oh, well, that's easy. So what we did on the CIDR team and Blend team is we wrote this thing called design instance. So this is a design time property I put at the top of my tree here on my grid, and it establishes a design time data context. This code is not included in your output of your build, whether it's debug or real. And what it does, design instance supplies shape to a data context to enable our tooling. That's really important. All right. So this way, if you have problems with your data bindings, you can now crack them open in our designer. And if you've got this D-data context here, you can now check if your binding is, if it's correct or not, right? Because if it doesn't work in the designer, it's not going to work at runtime. All right, now, over here in my category view, notice I got a little bit of sample data there. I got a little solid and dry. Yeah, I had to throw it in there, whatever. So over here, I got D-data context, and I assigned it to this thing called D-design data. Well, what's D-design data, Carl? Oh, what that is, that's our sample data implementation that Blend and CIDR both share. Everything I'm showing you works for Blend and CIDR. So in my sample data folder, I got this little file. See where it says category view? Here it is. I double-click on it. By the way, in case you don't know, XAML doesn't do anything except instantiate types and set properties. It doesn't do anything else. That's the only thing it does. It's a way to declaratively instantiate types and set properties. Okay? So the reason I said that is because it's applicable in this one case, because you can see here I'm newing up a category view model and I'm assigning some properties. Oh, solid and dry. Oh, that's kind of cool. How did that work? Oh, because it shows up right here. So to learn everything there is to know about sample data, you want to go over to my other blog, which is the WPF and Serverlight Designer blog. And I've got all kinds of, this article here is huge, and it covers so many sample data scenarios, RIA services, Serverlight, WPF, all different kinds. You want to know about sample data? This is the Bible. This is the best thing on the internet right now that I know of. I'm just being factual. I don't ever toot my horn. I don't believe in that. Pride becomes for a fall, and so I don't believe in that. Over here, I have an article on the same blog for how to debug your data bindings. If you're having a problem with a value showing up, you come here. It'll help you. All right. No more horn tuning. Promise. All right. So that was pretty simple. All right. Now let me show you. Let's take you to the big guy. So the big guy here, which is this dude, he's got, wow, this is a pretty complex thing going on here, Carl. Wow, you got your item with three, you got three over there, this thing's all filled up. I can see how everything's going to look at design time. I can alter my data templates by sitting there typing them, and then I can get a visual. Well, that's pretty cool. How'd you do that? Well, I did it real simple, because I don't ever do anything complicated. So how'd you do it, Carl? Right here. D data context. D design instance. Remember, now that was the first one used, but that didn't show sample data. That just gave me a shape. How did you get that? Well, because you have a property here called is design time creatable. So if you set that to true, this software here is going to go and instantiate that type and set it as the data context. No magic going on here whatsoever. So the type, it's going to go create this inventory view model sample data. So what I did is I went and I typed myself up a class. And by the way, Word's going to show you some other ways to do the same thing. We're trying to give you many different options. So here's my inventory view model sample data. I have it wrapped in ifdebug so it doesn't go out the door. You could also put it in a separate assembly. I didn't do that. But look at this. It's all the same properties that the other view model has. And you say, well, how'd you do all the sample data? Oh, most of it's done in this one line of code. Because I got a data generator that you can have. It generates all different kinds of data for you. And you can see here, I go make a description. I say, get data, give me a string 50 long. Give me email, next integer, skip 3, boolean, blah, blah, blah. Name, address, image, phone number. It does all that stuff. Social security numbers. It'll make you any kind of data you want. And down here, I had to create this little mock here for those things that showed up on the other side. So this is how I did this in just a few lines of code. Look what I was able to do for me. I was able to give myself a nice designer or developer design time experience, or designer could appreciate this in Blend, and everything works good for them. It's fantastic. Okay, does anybody have... So we covered a lot of stuff, right? And what the purpose of the talk was to try to show you and to expose you to what we're doing in Prism V4. Showed you some region discovery, that was, or some view discovery. That was neat, how we built a little menu. And if you look at our quick starts, we got some really cool ones where it actually, each module loads up in a kind of an Outlook style. We got email, we got calendar, and contacts. It's really neat, where you can go and learn how to take our simple examples that are very functional and teach the APIs, and you can consume those APIs. We also ship our binaries, our sign now. Prism binaries or sign binaries. It's fantastic. So I also showed you how to implement our navigation. It's a matter of hooking up a region and then using a little bit of code, request navigate. Presto, you're there. Very easy. It allows you to navigate to some object, and then it also allows you to, when you navigate away, to either keep it there or destroy it.